the family will rip them back down to earth until they cry for mercy. Then we lift them back up off the ground and serve them a drink. There are always a few tears shed, but 100% forgiveness by the time we leave. Because as my brother Rooster says, well, if everything we did was right, we'd never know what the hell was wrong. I've been on the receiving end of a few of these humble pie interventions, but not this year. No, my family knew I was going through a challenging time. If anything, they were wondering just what in the hell was wrong with me turning down regular work and hefty paychecks. But they could tell my mind was made up, and my family always respected sincere conviction, which I now had. A couple of days after Christmas, Rooster, Pat, and I were riding around the ranch sipping beers in Pat's maroon dually truck, when Pat, who was then and still is a pipe salesman working for Rooster, decided to call into his answering service to see what business-related messages he might have missed over the Christmas break. Pat had one of those 24/7 virtual receptionist services where you call in with your ID number and they relay your missed messages. He dialed the 1-800 digit. This is 812, he says. Yes, 812, give me just a moment. About 10 seconds passed. Sir, that account appears to not be active. Well, what do you mean, not active? Well, I mean, sir, that it is out of service. Wait, but that's the ID you gave me to call in and check my messages. Well, I understand that, sir, but account 812 has, it says here, been inactive for over 2 years. Pat, beginning to fume, immediately slammed the brakes, hopped out of the truck, and started yelling at the other end of the line. What do you mean it's been down for 2 years? Do you know how many millions of dollars that I've lost from business calls coming in to me to buy my pipe from me, and they couldn't even leave a goddamn message for me because you had my account inactive? I'm going to sue your ass. I'm taking you to court. 2 years my account's been down, and it's your fault.
Sir, I'm just the person who answers the phone and connects people with their accounts, and yours, sir, is not active.
Now, I don't give a damn what you say. I probably lost at least $10 million because you haven't been taking my messages in over 2 years. $10 million, lady. That's what I'm suing you for.
She hung up on him. Pat continued his rant.
No, don't you dare hang up on me, you hear me? You owe me.
Finally closing his flip phone, Pat kicked the dirt, then turned to me and Rooster, who had been witnessing the tirade.
Can you believe that shit? 2 years they've had my account inactive. 2 fucking years, man. I'm suing those fuckers. Suing them for $10 million. I'll take this shit all the way to the Supreme Court if I have to.
That's when Rooster asked Pat a question he obviously had not considered.
Well, little brother, what do you think the judge is going to say in court when he finds out that you didn't even know it was down because you hadn't even called in to check your messages in over 2 years?
Case closed. I guess everybody in my family does have a passion for prosecution. We just have trouble picking litigations we can win.
Bumper sticker. If we all made sense of humor the default emotion, we'd all get along a lot better.
The next day, Camilla, Levi, and I had to cut the holiday soiree short and head back home to take care of a more time-sensitive affair. I believe trying to maintain a honeymoon glow in a relationship is a fool's errand's fantasy. Worse yet, it's unfair to the two lovers trying to maintain it. It's a 120-watt bulb that burns too hot to last. No one can live up to the pedestal we put them on if we always put them on one. As well, when we only see our lover as superhuman, our reflection in their eyes makes us one of them in theirs. Then we're both for rent, because we're both unobtainable. The honeymoon, like Hollywood, is an animated movie. It's larger than life, not a reality we should expect to see once we exit the theater. Where we live, where our humanity lives, where our secrets, scars, fears, hopes, and failures reside, this is what comes after the credits roll. Where real love cares, hurts, understands, falls down, and gets back up. Where it's not easy, but we get to honestly try. The 20-watt bulb isn't enough light to show the way if I expect you to be Wonder Woman and you only see me as Mr. Incredible. The 100-watt honeymoon bulb is superhuman. by design. It's the beginning, the first time, the birth. That's why it's called a honeymoon, not a marriage. It's not obtainable or sustainable. Until you have a daughter. On January 3rd, 2010, Vita Alves McConaughey was born. The only honeymoon that lasts forever. Green light. Prescription. Define success for yourself. I went to a voodoo shop south of New Orleans the other day. It had vials of magic potions stacked in columns with labels defining what they would give you. Fertility, health, family, legal help, energy, forgiveness, money. Guess which column was sold out? Money. Yep. Money is still king currency today. Money is success. The more we have, the more successful we are, right? Even our cultural values have been financialized. Humility is not in vogue anymore. It's too passive. We can get rich quick on an internet scam, be an expert at nothing but everything if we say we are, get famous for our sex tape, and attain wealth, fame, rank, and power, even respect, without having a shred of competence for anything of value. It happens every day. We all want to succeed. The question we need to ask ourselves is, what is success to us? More money? That's fine. A healthy family, a happy marriage, helping others, to be famous, spiritually sound, to express ourselves, to create art, to leave the world a better place than we found it? What is success to me? Continue to ask yourself that question. How are you prosperous? What is your relevance? Your answer may change over time, and that's fine, but do yourself this favor. Whatever your answer is, don't choose anything that will jeopardize your soul. Prioritize who you are, who you want to be, and don't spend time with anything that antagonizes your character. Don't depend on drinking the Kool-Aid. It's popular. Tastes sweet today, but it will give you cavities tomorrow. Life is not a popularity contest. Be brave. Take the hill. But first, answer the question, what's my hill? A year went by. Dozens of romantic comedy offers came my way. Only romantic comedy offers came my way. I read them out of respect, but I stayed the course, stuck to the plan, and ultimately passed on them all. Now, just how puritanical was I about it? Well, I got a $5 million offer for 2 months' work on one of them. I read it, and I passed. Then they offered $8 million. Nope. Then they offered $10 million. No, thank you. Then they offered $12.5 million. Not this time, but thanks anyway. Then they offered $14.5 million. You know what? Let me reread that. And you know what? It was a better script. It was funnier, more dramatic, just an overall higher quality script than the first one I read with the $5 million offer. I mean, it was the same script with the exact same words in it, but it was far superior to the previous ones. I declined the offer. If I couldn't do what I wanted, I wasn't going to do what I didn't, no matter the price. Bumper sticker, truth's like a jalapeno. The closer you get to the root, the hotter it gets. A sense of humor helped me cope. A strong woman by my side kept me steadfast. And an infant son and newborn daughter to raise kept me busy. Together, they all helped me navigate my self-induced hiatus from Hollywood. I continually had to reinforce my belief that my holdout was a form of delayed gratification, that today's abstinence was an investment that would give me ROI tomorrow, that my personal protest was going to mail residuals to my soul down the road, that I was, as Warren Buffett says, buying straw hats in the winter. But being out of the limelight, not working, was taking its toll. I've always needed work for my own sense of self-significance. For 18 years, I'd had the honor of being addicted to acting and making movies, and now, without it, my dependency on it was causing a good amount of anxiety. With each rom-com offer that came in, I couldn't help but think about the opportunity to work again, on anything. My need for immediate personal accomplishment had me fighting against the temptation to do what I had always felt privileged to be able to do in the first place. While fighting for the necessity to have my art, my work, more resemble myself and my life. 10 more months went by.
It was evident that the industry, the studio heads, the producers, the directors, the casting agents, all of them had gotten my message, because now nothing came in. No rom-coms, nada. Not one single offer for anything. A total of 20 months had passed where I said no to anything that had defined my brand before. Rom-com guy? No. Shirtless on the beach guy? Nope. No beaches or paparazzi in Austin. For 20 months, I did not give the public or the industry any more of what they had banked on me to give them. No more of what they expected and even assumed to know. For 20 months, I removed myself from the public eye. At home in Texas with Camilla, I was raising Levi and Vita, gardening, writing, praying, visiting old friends, spending time with family, and recoiling from relapse. The industry didn't know where I was, just what I wasn't doing. Out of sight, I was out of mind. It seemed I was forgotten.
Prescribe. Voluntary obligations. Moms and dads teach us things as children. Teachers, mentors, the government, and laws all give us guidelines to navigate life, rules to abide by in the name of accountability and order. I'm not talking about those obligations. I'm talking about the ones we make with ourselves, the you versus you obligations, not the societal regulations and expectations that we acknowledge and endow for anyone other than ourselves. These are faith-based responsibilities that we make on our own, the ones that define our constitution and our character. They are secrets with ourselves, personal protocols, private counsel in the court of our own conscience. And while nobody will give us a medal or throw us a party when we abide by them, no one will apprehend us when we don't, because no one will know except us. An honest man's pillow is his peace of mind. And when we lie down on ours at night, no matter who's in our bed, we all sleep alone. The voluntary obligations are our personal Jiminy Crickets. And there are not enough cops in the entire world to police them. It's on us. Then, after just shy of 2 years of being gone from the industry and sending a very deliberate message to Hollywood as to what I was not anymore, I suddenly and unexpectedly became something. A new good idea. The anonymity and unfamiliarity had bred creativity. Casting Matthew McConaughey as the defense attorney in Lincoln Lawyer was now a fresh thought. Going to McConaughey for the lead in Killer Joe was now a novel notion. Richard Linklater called me for Bernie. Lee Daniels came to me for The Paperboy. Jeff Nichols wrote Mud for me. Steven Soderbergh called for Magic Mike. Yes, by saying no. The target drew the arrow. I was remembered by being forgotten. I had unbranded. I was a rediscovery, and now it was time to invent. My sacrifice complete, I had weathered the storm. Organized, I knew what I wanted, and I was ready to respond. It was time for me to say yes and rebrand. Fuck the bucks. I'm going for the experience. Green light.
Note to self, time and truth. Two constants you can rely on. One shows up for the first time every time, while the other never leaves. The offers came in droves, almost as many as after A Time to Kill. The difference this time was that I knew what roles and stories I wanted to do, and my appetite for dangerous dramatic fare was ravenous. Camilla's appetite for her man carving his own path had teeth as well. At one point, I had offers for roles in The Paperboy, Magic Mike, and Mud, all three of which I dearly wanted to do. But their production schedules were going to be back to back to back if I did all three, leaving me only a few weeks in between each to prepare if I did them all. I remember saying to Camilla, I think I have to choose two of the three so I have the 8 weeks I need to prepare for the two movies I choose to do. What, do you want to do all three? She asked. Yeah, I do, but the schedule's too tight for me to prepare like I think I need to. Look, if you want to do all three, then reach between your legs and grab your pair, big boy. Do all three. You'll make it work. I did, and it did. I'd read the Dallas Buyers Club script in 2007 and immediately attached myself to it as the actor who would play the lead character, Ron Woodruff. Once again, I was drawn to a character on the fringes of society,
an underdog, an outlaw, doing what was necessary to survive. Being attached meant I had control of the script and could try and get it made, as well as approve the director. For the few years before and during my 20-month sabbatical, no directors or financiers were interested in making a period drama about AIDS with rom-com McConaughey in the lead. Even early into my rebranding phase with the so-called McConaissance picking up steam, nobody was interested. Plenty of other actors tried to take control of the script away from me, and many other directors wanted to make the film with someone other than me. But I held on to it with a firm hand. Oh, speaking of McConaissance, did you know that I made up, coined, and created the term McConaissance? I did. I was at Sundance with Mudd in 2013 when I sat down for an interview with MTV. I'd been on a pretty good career run, and I figure it needed a campaign slogan of some kind, an anthem, a bumper sticker. But I knew it couldn't come from me. Well, you've been on quite a run, Mr. McConaughey. Killer Joe, Bernie, Magic Mike, now Mudd. Congratulations, the journalist said. Thank you, man. Yeah, I'm on a great ride. I actually did an interview the other day, and the journalist called it a McConaissance, I replied. Oh, my gosh, the McConaissance. That's brilliant. That may stick. It did. I've never told anybody that story until now. Then, in January of 2012, my agent told me a Canadian director named Jean-Marc Vallée had read the script and was interested in meeting me. I watched a film of his, Crazy, and liked it for all the right reasons. Unsentimental humor and heart, with anarchy wrapped around a dreamer's humanity. It also had a badass soundtrack, which I still have no idea how he got on the low budget he had. This was exactly what I felt the Dallas Buyers Club script needed to bring it to life. We met in New York and discussed our passion for the project. Having recently done Magic Mike, I was in excellent physical shape. This character, this Ron Woodruff, he has a stage 4 HIV, Mathieu. How are you going to look like you do? He asked. Well, because it's my job to, and I will, I told him. It's my responsibility to Ron. A week later, he agreed to direct. Jean-Marc, the producers Robbie Brenner, Rachel Winter, and I made a plan to make the film in October of that year. Weighing 182 pounds at the time, I had a lot of weight to lose. 5 months out from our agreed-upon start date, I began shedding weight. 3 egg whites in the morning, 5 ounces of fish and a cup of vegetables for lunch, the same for dinner, and as much wine as I wanted was my diet. I shed 2.5 pounds a week like clockwork. At 157 pounds with more to lose, I received a call from Martin Scorsese offering me the 2-day role of the broker mentor Mark Hanna to Leonardo DiCaprio's Jordan Belfort in the film Wolf of Wall Street. Remember what I said about those launch pad lines? Well, when I read this script and saw that Mark Hanna's secret to successful stockbrokering was cocaine and hookers, I took flight. Delusional or not, anyone who believed that could have an encyclopedia written about him. So I started writing it. In what was originally scripted as a much shorter scene, I went off into a lunatic to the marvelous musical riff-rap that ended up being what's in the film today. Scorsese let me play and DiCaprio teed me up. And that chest-bumping hum tune? That was something I was doing before each take to relax and keep my rhythm. Mm-hmm. It was Leonardo's idea for me to do it in the scene. Note to self. We're all storytellers in the movie business. That's what we do. We play make-believe. And when we do it well, we make you believe. We're shooting in the fall, I'd say to anyone who asked about Dallas Buyers Club and to everyone who didn't. Like my mom, I was not asking permission. But there's no money to make this movie, Matthew. There is no movie, my agent said. Well, yes, there is, I said. We're shooting in the fall. I was not going to flinch. I continued to lose the weight needed to tell the story properly. Now down to 150 pounds from 182, my body was getting weak, but my mind was getting stronger. Every pound I physically lost seemed to be sublimating an equal amount to more mental acuity. Like Ron, I was becoming clinical, meticulous, methodical, and a perfectionist. I needed 3 hours less sleep a night and could drink a bottle of wine until 2 a.m. and still be up at 4 to work on the script without an alarm clock. Feverishly obsessed with my man, I was on fire and I loved it. The downfall was that while my mental game was on the mound in Game 7 of the World Series, the extreme weight loss seemed to relegate my libido to the dugout. Screenwriter Craig Borton had given me over 10 hours of cassette recordings of Ron while he was creating and then running his alternative HIV medication buyer's club. I listened to them constantly, picking up intonation and intention, moments of bravado and vulnerability. There was one section of recording where he and another male voice were conversing with two other women who were in the background. There was a seditiously sexual undertone in the way they talked to each other. I could tell their carnal activity with each other was recent. But how, I thought. Ron's got stage 4 HIV. I mean, they couldn't be... Unless they all had HIV. Of course. How interesting. Geez, how wild. How true. I took the tape to Jean-Marc and had him listen. Look, is there any way that we can get this into the movie? I asked. Wow. There's something so sad and beautiful about it, he said. But I don't know how I could touch it without it seeming ugly. Jean-Marc and I didn't speak of it again. But as you'll hear, he never forgot it. I drove to see Ron Woodruff's sister and daughter in their home in a small rural town outside of Dallas. They greeted me with open arms and complete trust as the chaperone of their brother and father's legacy. We watched old VHS tapes of Ron and the family, Ron on vacation, showing off for the camera, dressed for Halloween. They were honest about who Ron was, who he was not, and answered every question I had. As we hugged goodbye, his sister asked, "Would you be interested in his diary? He kept one for years." "Well, if you'd allow me, I'd be honored," I said. While the hours of tapes gave me an insight to the man from the outside in, the diary let me know who he was from the inside out. It was my secret key into Ron Woodruff's soul. The diary told me who Ron was on lonely nights. It was where he shared his dreams and fears with no one but himself, and now me. His diary is how I found him. Who he was after contracting HIV, but even more importantly, who he was before. I remember a guy who would lie in bed on a weeknight smoking a joint, drawing doodles in a spiral notebook, writing things like, "Hope I get that call back tomorrow morning to go install those two JVC home speakers at Tom and Betty Wickman's house. They live across town about 42 miles away, so I figure $8 gas there and back, $6 for the monster cable speaker wire I got to supply. Let me see, that'll clear me $24 off the $38 I'm charging them to install the speakers. Hot damn! I'll hit the Sonic afterwards and get me a double cheeseburger and a taste of Nancy." Then he'd wake up early the next morning, iron his one pair of slacks, his short sleeve button down, and put a fresh AA battery in his pager while he sipped his second cup of coffee, preparing to make a $24 profit out of his day. Until his pager buzzed. Tom and Betty's number. "We're going to cancel the speaker install today, Ron. Found a company that costs a little more than you, but they'll ensure their work. Thanks, Ron." His heart would sink. "God damn it," he wrote. Then he'd get high and head to that Sonic in spite of it all. Buy a single instead of a double and flirt up Nancy Blankenship, who he thought was pretty cute, especially as she roller skated out to his car door with his food order and smiled her one brown tooth smile. "She's my lucky 16," he wrote. Well, come to find out, 16 was the room number of the nearest two-star motel where he and Nancy Blankenship would shag up from time to time. That's why she was lucky. Ron invented things but wouldn't follow up on a patent. He made plans, but they never quite happened. He was a dreamer, and he couldn't catch a break. Meanwhile, Jean-Marc Vallée and the producers continued to cast and crew the film in scattered locations in New Orleans. They did not ask permission. They did not flinch. Still, it does take money to make a movie, and we were running out of time on our bluff. Except we weren't bluffing, and I was still losing weight. "We're shooting in New Orleans in the fall. The start date is October 1st, we declared again more loudly to anyone who asked and everyone who didn't. Finally, someone believed us, or believed in us. Because that someone put up $4.9 million to finance the movie. It wasn't the $7 million the film was budgeted for, but it was enough to get us in the game. 8 days before we were to begin principal photography in New Orleans, I got a call from Jean-Marc. Matthew, I do not know how I am going to shoot the film for $4.9 million, he said. The lowest possible budget to make it is $7 million, but if you will be there on day one, I will be there on day one, and we will see what we can make. We both showed up. Matthew, I've been thinking about the cassette recording that you played me of Ron and the ladies, and I have an idea, Jean-Marc said to me a couple of weeks into shooting. In the scripted scene where Ron's business is doing so well, what if you're in the next door motel room and you see in the line of the people coming in to buy their HIV drugs, a girl that you find very attractive, and you ask a secretary if the girl has HIV? Yes, full-blown HIV, she says back to you. Then we see Ron and this woman in the bathroom shower stall, like fucking, like for need and for survival. Jeez. Sounds beautiful and true. You know how to not make it ugly? I asked. I do, he said. When you view the scene, you understand why he did. It's human, it's heartbreaking, and it's funny. While Ron and the woman are shagging in the shower next door, Jean-Marc cuts to the office where we see the secretaries and patrons hearing them. Then looking around at each other in mild surprise with mischievous grins of hilarity and compassion. With humor, Jean-Marc exposed the humanity. What he did not know how to make ugly, he made beautiful. We made Dallas Buyers Club for $4.9 million in 25 days. We did not ask permission. We did not flinch. We took the hill. I got down to 135. Green light. Part 8. Live your legacy now. November 7th, 2011. Why is it Mama McConaughey? My inquisitive 3-year-old son Levi asked me one day. Well, what do you mean? I asked. Well, I'm Levi McConaughey. Vita's Vita McConaughey, but Mama is Camila Alves. Why doesn't she have our last name? I thought for a second. Because we're not married yet. Well, why not? He asked. If you're a parent, then you know that there are questions our children ask us that as soon as the words come out of their mouth, we know we better have a great answer. Because what we say next is going to be branded in their memories for life. This was one of those times. Well, it's a good question. I do want to marry Mama. I just don't feel the need to. If I marry Mama, I want to feel like I need to. I don't want to do it because that's what we're supposed to do or because I merely want to. I want to do it when that's what I need to do. Are you afraid to? He asked. Another one of those questions. I was on the stand. Apparently, my 3-year-old son inherited my debating skills and cross-examination capabilities. I thought again. Yeah, I guess I am a little bit. Afraid of what? He asked. Of losing myself, I said. The next day, I went to my pastor. We talked about the sacrament of marriage and getting beyond my fears. He talked to me about the mystery of marriage and how when two people who are meant to be together unite, the adventure of living side by side does not steal the individual's sense of self, rather it enlightens and informs it. How when two people come together to marry, they each arrive as one whole being. And in marriage, we don't lose half ourselves, we become more of ourselves. Through this covenant with God and our spouse, we actually triple our existence and become 3 times what we were. 3 entities, wife, husband, and God, in unification, unanimous. 1 times 1 equals 3, a mystical multiplication. It takes courage and sacrifice, he said. Then he challenged me. What's the bigger risk for you, Matthew? Going on this adventure or continuing on the one you're on? The dare. It got me thinking. I spent the next few weeks talking to my pastor, my brother, and successfully married men about it. Soon, for the first time in my life, I got the courage to look at marriage not as a final destination, rather as a new expedition, an affirmative and heartfelt choice to become more together with the woman I wanted to spend the rest of my life with, and the only mother I wanted to be rocking with on my 88th birthday. For the first time, I began seeing marriage as more than only a biblical and legislative sanction that I was supposed to feel responsible for enacting. Marrying Camilla became something I needed to do. I bent my knee and proposed to her on Jesus' birthday in 2011. She said yes, but we didn't set a date for the ceremony.
Note to self. You just live together, you live for the present. You marry, you live for the future. Lily Finney Zanuck.
Camilla might have seemed totally unlike my mom, but in May 2012, 5 months after I proposed, she did to me exactly what my mom had done to my dad, just with an extra bonus. She handed me an invitation to my own wedding.
Sure, I said. All I need is a date.
Then she handed me another ultrasound. I have our third child growing in my belly, hon, and I am not walking the aisle on my wedding day with a bump showing. We invited 88 of our closest friends and family. We put 44 tents in the yard to hold those 88 friends captive for an entire 3-day wedding weekend. And less than a month later, on June the 13th, 2012, Camilla Araujo Alves became Camilla Alves McConaughey. Brother Christian from the monastery presided over the Catholic ceremony. Our local pastor, Dave Haney, did the introductory salutations. John Mellencamp played the psalms. And a Candomblé priestess blessed us in African-Brazilian magic. My brother Rooster said to me after the wedding, "Hey, little brother, if there is a heaven, I'm pretty sure you got it covered." That night at the altar, Camilla looked me in the eyes and said, "I don't want nothing, just all you got to give." Me, I didn't marry the woman of my dreams that night. I married the best one on earth for me. And she's a mermaid. Afraid no more and in pursuit of a new mystery, I committed to the commitment. And for the first time in my life, felt I could tumble and not fall. I knew it would be harder because now, as husband and wife, there was more to work for. No longer chasing butterflies, Camilla and I planted our garden so they could come to us. My mother could finally put away the whiteout. And Levi had one last question. Green light. I'd met two men named Livingston in my lifetime. Both were men that I first noticed from a distance. Similar to seeing Camilla in the club that night, they were impressions. Both were upright, strong, and sturdy men who carried themselves with honor, constitution, and a manner of earned aristocracy. Lumberjacks by day, conductors of the Philharmonic by night, real Renaissance men, well-versed in the art of living. I got to know these two men quite well over time, and upon closer inspection, the two of them turned out to be the very definition of my first impression. I wanted to meet a third. So, at 7:43 a.m., December the 28th, 2012, Livingston Alves McConaughey was born. Green light. I was as fulfilled in my life as I'd ever been. Married, with three children like my father, I was finding inspiration everywhere. But now in truths, not ideas. Unimpressed with my success, I was involved in it. Wanting what I needed and needing what I wanted. The more successful I became, the more sober I got. I liked my company so much, I didn't want to interrupt it.
Note to self, the closer I get to divinity, the more I wonder if I'm a fraud. I'm pretty sure it's because I still need to learn how to win.
I received an offer for a lead role in an 8-part limited series for HBO called True Detective. The script by Nick Pizzolatto was so white hot on the page that I could feel the blood come off it. The fact that it was on the small screen didn't make me hesitate because the story and characters had such clear and original identities. The role I was offered was that of Marty Hart. The role I wanted was Rustin Cole, the greatest detective I'd ever met. I couldn't wait to turn the page to see what came out of his mouth next. An island of a man who lived between the mortal respect of death and the immortal need for its deliverance. A man who, without sentiment, fiercely sought the truth no matter how much it burned. He made me sweat in my boots.
"If I can be Rustin Cole, I'm in," I told him.
After a couple of days of mulling over my notion, Nick, The director, Kerry Joji Fukunaga, and the producers agreed to give me Mr. Rustin Cole. My great friend Woody Harrelson came aboard to play Marty Hart. Thankfully, he hadn't played any characters that bred copycat killers since the last time. My family and I soon packed up and moved back to New Orleans for the 6-month shoot. I've always had a soft spot for the Crescent City. Maybe because my dad was raised there and my family visited his mom and her sisters for the Blessing of the Fleet Shrimp Festival every year growing up. Maybe because I'd also filmed 4 of my last 5 movies there. Maybe because if you want to know if you're in the good part of town or the bad, the locals' rhythmic rationale will tell you. Well, sir, there's a little bad in the good parts and a little good in the bad parts. It's always felt like home. Places are like people. They each have a particular identity. In all my travels around the globe, I've written in my journal about the culture of a place, its identity. If a place and a people move me, I'll write them a love letter. New Orleans is one of those places. Dear New Orleans, oh, what a big, beautiful mess you are. A giant, flashing yellow light. Proceed with caution, but proceed. Not overly ambitious, you have a strong identity. And don't look outside yourself for intrigue, evolution, or monikers of progress. Proud of who you are, you know your flavor. It's your very own. And if people want to come taste it, you welcome them without solicitation. Your hours trickle by. Tuesdays and Saturdays more similar than anywhere else. Your seasons slide into one another. You're the Big Easy, home of the shortest hangover on the planet, where a libation greets you on a Monday morning with the same smile it did on Saturday night. Home of the front porch, not the back. This engineering feat provides so much of your sense of community and fellowship as you relax facing the street and your neighbors across it. Rather than retreating into the seclusion of the backyard, you engage with the goings-on of the world around you on your front porch. Private properties hospitably trespass on each other and lend across borders where a 9 a.m. alarm clock is church bells, sirens, and a slow-moving 8-buck-an-hour carpenter nailing window pane 2 doors down. You don't sweat details or misdemeanors, and since everybody's getting away with something anyway, the rest just want to be on the winning side. And if you can swing the swindle, good for you, because you love to gamble and rules are made to be broken. So don't preach about them. Abide. Peddling worship and litigation. Where else do the dead rest eye to eye with the living? You're a right brain city. Don't show up here wearing your morals on your sleeve lest you want to get your arm burned. The humidity suppresses most reason. So if you're crossing a one-way street, it's best to look both ways. Mother Nature rules. The natural law, capital Q, queen who reigns supreme. A science to the animals, an overbearing and inconsiderate bitch to us bipeds. But you forgive her, and quickly, because you know any disdain with her wrath will reap more bad luck, voodoo, karma. So you roll with it. Meander, rather. Slowly forward, taking it all in stride, never sweating the details. Your art is in your overgrowth. Mother Nature wears the crown around here. Her royalty rules, and unlike in England, she has both influence and power. You don't use vacuum cleaners. No, you use brooms and rakes to manicure. Where it falls is where it lays. The swerve around the pothole, the duck beneath the branch, the poverty and the murder rate, all of it just how it is and how it turned out. Like a gumbo, your medley's in the mix. June 7, 2013, New Orleans, Louisiana. When True Detective aired, Camilla and I watched it every Sunday night like everyone else. I obviously had the opportunity to see it all in one sitting prior to its release, but I chose to digest it as it was designed to be consumed. 1 hour every Sunday night, followed by water cooler talk on Monday morning with anticipation for the next episode. It was my favorite thing on TV. Still is. At the same time it was televised, I was on the road campaigning for award season with Dallas Buyers Club. Looking back, I see that in many ways my role and work in True Detective was an MVP of my run for Best Actor in Dallas Buyers Club. It was a weekly crusade for me, the best advertisement money couldn't buy. There I was, in your living rooms every Sunday night as Rustin Cole, then the next day in your face as Ron Woodruff on the campaign trail. The Critics' Choice, Golden Globes, Independent Spirit, and Screen Actors Guild all presented me with the Best Actor Award for my performance as Ron Woodruff. Next up was the final ceremony of the year, the Academy Awards. I didn't have a speech plan because I believe that truly would be bad karma, but I did have a short list of what I wanted to talk about if, in fact, the Academy did call my name. My note to self? What I need? What I'm thankful for? Who's my hero? They called my name. I won the Oscar for Best Actor. I was extremely honored to receive this award representing the pinnacle of excellence in my profession. It was also validation that my choices as an actor were translating as a highly competent craft. I was not half-assing it. Green light. Note to self, there's a difference between art and self-expression. All art is self-expression. All self-expression is not art. I went on to make Interstellar with Chris Nolan, Sea of Trees with Gus Van Sant, Free State of Jones with Gary Ross, Gold with Steven Gagan, White Boy Rick with Jan Demange, Serenity with Stephen Knight, The Beach Bum with Harmony Korine, and The Gentleman with Guy Ritchie. I also made a few movies for my kids, Kubo and the Two Strings with Travis Knight, and Sing 2 with Garth Jennings. I also became a successful car salesman as brand ambassador for Lincoln Motor Company, as well as becoming the creative director for Wild Turkey Bourbon. All characters and creations I wanted to investigate, inhabit, and become. All stories I found fascinating, original, and worth telling. All experiences I would not trade. But very few box office successes. Something was not translating. I was inviting the public, but there were empty seats in the theater. Was it me? The subject matter? The films themselves? The distributors? Bad luck? Changing times? I don't know for sure. Little of each and more of some, I suppose. The box office failures did not dampen my love of acting. If anything, they made me more feverishly committed to my craft. I loved performing. I loved creating. I loved getting lost in a character, then found. I loved going so deep as to see my man from the inside out. I loved the work, the process, the construction, the architecture of building and owning my man. I loved having a wife who never interrupted my belief that each role I played was the only and last role I'd ever play. I loved acting more than ever. So much so, I began to notice that the characters and films I was doing were feeling more vital than who I was and the story that was my life. In my career now, I was more than an entertainer. I was an actor, an artist, and that satisfied me. My career was full, wild, dangerous, essential, consequential, lively. I laughed louder, cried harder, loved bigger, loathed deeper, and felt more in the characters I was playing in the movies than the man I was living in my life. I said to myself, you flipped the script, McConaughey. Tip the scale to the other side. Prescribe. Why pray? It's a time to take inventory. To take a look from high and wide at ourselves, our loved ones, and our mortality. A time to smile upon our blessings, to humble our selfish yearnings, to embrace those we know are in need with our compassion, and see them in our mind's eye as their most true selves. A snapshot down memory lane of those we know and care for when they were most themselves. Not the happiest or the proudest, not the saddest or most reflective, but that image of them when we see, without advertisement or desire, their light shine within. And finally see ourselves the same before we say amen. When we are who we are and no one else. I was more alive in my movies than in my life. The stories in my profession seemed more vibrant than the story I was living. Impressions in the mirror. Time to make a change. So I made a plan. Time to get rid of the filters. Make my life my favorite movie. Live my favorite character. Write my own script. Direct my own story. Be my biography. Make my own documentary on me. Nonfiction, live, not recorded. Time to catch that hero I've been chasing. See if the sun will melt the wax that holds my wings or if the heat is just a mirage. Live my legacy now. Quit acting like me. Be me. So, I gathered 35 years of my writings on the last 50 and took them to desolate places to seek their prudence, hear their story, and take inventory on my investment. Me. I spent 2 weeks alone in the desert where I was conceived, 2 more on the river where I learned to swim, another 2 in a cabin nestled in the piney woods of East Texas, 3 more in a motel room on the Mexican border, and 2 more locked up in a New York City apartment. In each place, I looked myself in the eye, all 50 years of me. It was a scary proposition, alone with the one person responsible for all of it, the one person I can't get rid of. I wasn't sure I'd like what I saw. I knew it could get bloody. And it did. I laughed. I cried. I wrestled. I wowed. I also had the best time with the best company I have ever had in my life. Note to self. Friends. While we're here, where we believe more than we know, we enjoy succeeding. We don't have to look over our shoulders when we keep our own counsel, writing our book, the star of our story, traveling toward immortal finish lines where we make friends with ourselves. So, here I am, 50 years in, looking back to look forward. What's it all about? What's my thesis, my coda, my summation, my final remarks? What have I learned? What do I know? As an armchair anthropologist, folk philosopher, and truth-seeking street poet, I've followed celestial suggestions, made associations, heard many voices, and dealt with reality by literally chasing down my dreams. I have rented, had flings, hobbies, affairs, and chased butterflies to who knows where. All stops, no stays on my resume's road to where I am today. I have found possessions, laws, relationships, careers, a wife and family, and dropped non-negotiable anchors when I did. When I watered their gardens, they sprang to life. And learned lessons went from planning to performance, from knowing to doing, from acting to being. That's when the butterflies started coming to my garden. I wrote this book so I could have a written record to hold myself accountable to. I wrote this book so you can hold me to task and remind me of what I forgot. I circled back to prior times, lessons learned, repeated, and revisited. I noticed that the realizations arrived quickly, the learning took time, and the living was the hardest part. I found myself right where I left me. My first 20 years were where I learned the value of values. Through discipline and deep affection, I learned respect, accountability, creativity, courage, perseverance, fairness, service, good humor, and a spirit of adventure in ways that some people might consider abusive, but I remember as tough love. And I wouldn't give back one ass whooping I ever got for the value of the values my parents impressed upon me. I thank them for that. My 20s and 30s were contradictory decades, years when I eliminated conditions and truths that went against my grain. The value in this conservative era was that it safeguarded me from fatal character debits early in life. It was a time when I was more often concerned with not running red lights than I was with investing in the green lights. I did what I wanted. I learned to live. I survived. My 40s were a much more affirming decade, years when I started to play offense with truths I had learned and put them into action, an era where I doubled down on what fed me. The value of this liberal age was that it illuminated my most life-endorsing character assets. It was a time when I not only cruised through more green lights because I had eliminated more red and yellow ones, but a time when I created more green lights to travel through. A time when past reds and yellows finally turned green as old hardships revealed themselves as good fortune. A time when the green lights beamed brighter because I gave them more power to shine. I did what I needed. I lived to learn. I thrived. As I approach the next chapter of Truths to Cross, the only thing I know for sure is that I will recalibrate again and that my family will be at the core when I do. As a father, I often contradict myself, and I know I could do a better job of practicing what I preach, but I've also learned that if the message is true, don't forget it and forgive the messenger, even if he does. I hope to give my children the opportunity to find what they love to do, work to be great at it, pursue it, and do it. Rather than cover their eyes from ugly truths, I want to cover their eyes from fictional fantasies that will handicap their ability to negotiate tomorrow's reality. I believe they can handle it. It's hard to find constants, natural laws, universal truths in life, but when we have kids, there is no intellectual discussion or philosophy as how to or how much to love, protect, and guide them. It's an instinctual commitment, an immediate, infinite, and ever-growing responsibility, a privilege, a green light. When I was putting the finishing touches on this book earlier this year, my life, like yours, was intercepted by a red light drama called COVID-19. Its disruption in our lives became inevitable. We had to stay home, social distance, and wear masks for protection. We couldn't go to work, we lost jobs and loved ones, and we never truly knew when it would end. We were scared, we were angry. Each of us had to make sacrifices, pivot, persist, and deal. We had to get relative. The tumultuous start to 2020 continued when another red light drama introduced itself in the name of the George Floyd murder. Its disruption in our lives soon became inevitable as well. There were protests, looting, riots, fear, and outrage. The unjust murder sparked a social justice revolution in America and around the world. And as racism reared its ugly head into the spotlight once again, we were reminded that all lives couldn't matter until Black lives mattered more. Each of us had to make sacrifices, pivot, persist, and deal. We had to get relative. Both of these red lights forced us inward, literally quarantined us to search our souls for a better way forward. In doing so, we took inventory of our lives and who we are in them, what we care about, what our priorities are, what matters. We got to know our children, families, and ourselves better. We read, we wrote, we prayed, we cried, we listened, we screamed, we spoke out, we marched, we helped others in need. But how much do we change for good? Its sake and forever. For those of us who survived, when and how we see the benefits of what we went through during those turbulent times is relative. But if we work individually to make the justified changes for a more value-driven and righteous tomorrow, the red light year that 2020 was will one day, in the rearview mirror of life, inevitably turn green and perhaps be seen as one of our finest hours. With reverence for the values my parents preached and a lifetime of traveling the world, I value culture and a culture of values. I also believe in the value of doing something well, convinced that the best road for ourselves and society lives on the path that leads to having more values and competence. I assumed the position of Minister of Culture /MOC last year, working to preserve and promote a culture of competence and shared values across cities, institutions, universities, academics, and athletics. Bipartisan and non-denominational, values are not only guiding principles we can all agree on, they are the fundamental ethics that bring people together. When we are competent at our values and place more value on competence, we create a more valuable society. And that means more return on our investment. Us. Which brings me back to the other reason I wrote this book. I hope it can be useful and lend a hand if you need it, that it might teach you something, inspire you, make you laugh, remind you, help you forget, and arm you with some tools to better march forward as more of yourself. Me? I haven't made all A's in the art of living. But I give a damn, and I'll take an experienced C over an ignorant A any day. I've always believed that the science of satisfaction is about learning when and how to get a handle on the challenges we face in life. When you can design your own weather, blow in the breeze. When you're stuck in the storm, pray for luck and make the best of it. We all have scars. We're going to get more. So rather than struggle against time and waste it, let's dance with time and redeem it. Because we don't live longer when we try not to die. We live longer when we're too busy living. As I've navigated the weather in my own life, getting relative with the inevitable has been a key to my success. Relatively, we are living. Life is our resume. It is our story to tell, and the choices we make write the chapters. Can we live in a way where we look forward to looking back? Inevitably, we are going to die. Our eulogy, our story will be told by others and forever introduce us when we are gone. The sole objective. Begin with the end in mind. What's your story? This is mine so far. Green lights. Here's to catching more of them. Just keep living. McConaughey. P.S. While writing this book, I found this note in a pile of my journal, buck slip, napkin, beer coaster notes and scribbles. I'd never seen it since the day I wrote it. Notice the date, 9/1/1992. 10 goals in life. 1, become a father. 2, find and keep the woman for me. 3, keep my relationship with God. 4, chase my best self. 5, be an egotistical utilitarian. 6, take more risks. 7, stay close to mom and family. 8, win an Oscar for best actor. 9, look back and enjoy the view. 10, just keep living. Notice that date, 9/1/92. That is 2 days after finishing my first ever acting role as Wooderson in Dazed and Confused. 14 days after my dad moved on. Like I said, I guess I remembered more than I forgot. Who do I want to acknowledge? I want to acknowledge and give thanks to my parents and brothers for giving me family, my wife and kids for creating my own, and the countless characters, inspirations, and ideals I've met along my way so far. Thank you to my heroes, from my brother Pat to Mellencamp to Me in 10 Years, and to all the people who gave me poems I wrote that I forgot I did. To my friends like Seth Robbins Bendler for the courage to trailblaze, Australia for the loneliness, Don Phillips for the sight, Richard Linklater for the scene, Cole Hauser for the individuality, Gus for the loyalty, Kevin Morse for the absolute, Mark Gustavus for the belief, Mark Norby for the simplicity, John Chaney for the steady hand, Nicole Perez Kruger for the right one, Blaine Lord for the extra zeros, Miss Hud for the commitment, Issa Ballow for the guidance, Molly for the home, Brother Christian for the humanity, Penny Allen for the ferocity, Pastor Day for the context, Jordan Peterson for the clarity, Chad Mountain for the ear, Dan Buettner for the adventures, Roy Spence for the purpose, Nick Pizzolatto for the honesty, Al Kohal for the ideas, Liz Lambert for the desert, Bart Nags for the Llano River, David Drake, Jillian Blake, and Matt Inman for the edits, and to WME Crown Penguin Random House and headline teams for helping me share my story on the page and on the audio from my mouth into your ears right now. This is Matthew McConaughey, and we sure hope you've enjoyed this production of Green Lights. This program was produced by Dan Zitt, director Nicole Shelton, editing by Jeff Robinette. Text copyright 2020 by Matthew McConaughey. Production copyright 2020 Penguin Random House LLC. All rights are reserved. Just keep living.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.